You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Very Lynchian feel.
I thought you were just being experimental and trying to do something different.
Did you like the style that he chose?
Convenient storytelling.
It is a check your brain at the door movie.
I don't think he lets things like continuity bother him.
This entire cast is great.
This sucks. I'm not watching this again. Why didn't he get with us? Because we always know how to fix these things.
So we can just jump into a car and drive to the mythical monster city?
That makes my gaydar ping a little bit.
It scared the crap out of me. Of course, a smile in general is creepy to me. It's like British children.
I'm telling you, them hobbits are gay. And that's why folks tune back in, because I know how to poke the bear.
You're the warrior. You've got to go into the horrible forest that's scary and terrifying, and you've got to kill the monster and rescue the princess.
That's Mario. One. Hello, out there in YouTube and podcast land, you have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that often lift and or separate them from the genre, average genre fare. Are you new to us? We would like to welcome to you here, me and my co-host David. We talk about movies.
Sometimes, yes.
Actually, we've been talking about movies for a very long time. The span of decades. And I won't go into any elaborate detail. But predominantly horror and science fiction. I'm more of a horror guy. David is more of a science fiction guy.
Oh, yeah.
And we like to find those elements that lift them above and or connect them to other movies that have either come after or precede them. And those of you that are back know that. You know that we're unscripted. We tend to ramble like I'm doing right now. And we like it that way because it is more natural. It is not scripted. It doesn't sound like a robot speaking with pictures on the screen. And I am here with my co-host and old friend, David Horton. David, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. And that was a good intro. I do love the fact that we don't script and don't talk through it. And it becomes more of a conversation. Yes, we tend to ramble sometimes, and contradict each other sometimes. But I think overall, it's more organic, which is a better feel. We were just talking offline about Apocalypse Now. Talk about an organic experience. There you go. But normally, we break the ice. For those of you coming back, this is our second episode of this season, and we're excited. But we normally break the ice with what have we done genre-related since we last spoke. And I finally caught up on Fallout. You know for a fact that I've mentioned Fallout several times. I loved all of the games, have played all of the games, and really got excited when they announced that Nolan and Joy were going to do the original, were going to do the series on Amazon Prime. And then they took a year, 18 months, and then finally came out with the second season. And
it's
waited.
Christopher Nolan's brother, right?
Correct. Correct. Okay. And it is just as good or even better than the first season.
Oh, cool.
Which says a lot. Because you've got great cast in this, but you've also got great expectation. And you've got a lot of ways they could go based on five different video games that are the inspiration for it. But instead, what they do, rather than like The Last of Us, everybody talked about, if you had played the game and watched season one, you basically knew everything that was going to happen in the season because it was basically playing the game, the masterful, full storyline of the game all the way through. Fallout was not like that. It was inspired by the games and had a lot of elements from the games, but it wasn't one of their plots thrown together. It was a bunch of them. And season two even expounds on that more. What really makes season two work is that you really get to see a lot more of, I always mispronounce his name, Walton Goggins. Is it Goggins or Goggins? I don't know.
I think what it's Goggins.
Okay. You see a lot more of him because there's a lot of flashbacks. They had a few flashbacks in season one, but season two has a lot more. And you see,
yeah, when he before he became Skullface.
Skullface. They call him the Ghoul.
Right. But he looks like the Red Skull.
He has no nose. Yes.
Yeah.
But you see a lot of his history of what happened and how he contributed and everything else, especially with this whole New Vegas sort of feel. I'm really curious to see if in season three, the way the games progressed was the early games were basically scrolling games and you were just surviving in the wasteland and stuff. And then they got into the whole West Coast sort of game with the third game. And then the fourth was New Vegas, which is essentially what this one is. And then the fifth game was Boston and Providence and that whole area in New England. I'm really curious if that's where
they'll go. Got your clam chowder.
I'm really curious if that's where they'll go next season. It's very Nolan and Joy, so it feels a lot like Westworld as far as the way the plotting goes, the way suddenly characters can show their really dark side or have to make choices that are very morally gray, is what they say now, sort of thing. And also huge implications to the other characters based on what they do, sort of thing. And they like that. They put that a lot in their stories of, because spoilers, if you haven't watched it, go watch it because it's really good. But one minor spoiler is in the games, it is said point blank, China is the reason that the apocalypse came. They were the first ones to launch nuclear weapons against the United States and Europe, and that's what caused it. By the second, it's hinted at in the very last episode of last season, but by the first season, first episode of season two, you know that in this world, the company that's in charge of all the fallout shelters dropped the first bomb and blamed it on the Chinese. They did it on purpose. So it's that very bad look, a very negative look at government and governments and everything else, which is very common right now, of they're manipulating you. They will do whatever they want to make you do what they want you to do, sort of thing. And Nolan and Joy are very big on that. That's what Westworld was all about. Westworld was all about the evil corporation taking over the world and all of that. But it's great. The performances are great. The effects are really strong. The CGI works in it. It's not overplayed. And there's some really cool new elements they added to the Fallout world, which I'm curious to see what they'll do with in season three. So that's what I did.
I'll have to watch it.
Fallout, you really need to. It's really strong.
No, I've seen season one. I just haven't seen season two.
Yeah. Season two is strong. You'll like it.
Awesome.
What about you? Well, scary?
Of course, because I never have time to watch series anymore when I need to watch movies for genre week topics.
Of course.
And I decided to go back to 1962 with a little chestnut called Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Oh, my God. You know I have not watched that in decades.
Neither had I. And I watched it on a high-def television and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Really? Okay.
I did. First of all, it was pristine and so pristine that you could really see the wires on those paper plates that are flying through the space.
Yeah, I bet you could.
But, yeah, it's terrible. It is. But is it the worst movie ever made? I don't think so at all because it makes you laugh a lot. I laughed a lot out loud, which makes it a pretty decent comedy.
Does that turn it into camp? Is it Rocky Horror-y kind of laugh? Is Ed Wood kind of laughing?
No, it's Ed Wood kind of laughing because it's not intentional. It wasn't supposed to be funny. It was just done on the cheap. Some sets, like the spaceship sets, are literally curtains and a desk.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, and maybe a helmet. Let's see. What have I got here? As you mentioned, it's directed by Ed Wood. And some of the cast is actually decent. It's the script that's awful. And that's Ed Wood. And totally. Bela Lugosi was infamously inserted into this movie after he had died because him and Ed were friends, and Ed had just shot some footage of him coming out of his house in his Dracula costume or standing in a field. And then he hired his chiropractor to do a body double for him in other scenes when Lugosi was not filmed. And he's a foot taller and always has his cape up above his face so you can't see. The synopsis is, aliens led by Eros and Tana implement Plan 9 to resurrect Earth's dead. They aim to force humanity to stop creating destructive weapons like the Solarinite bomb. Solarinite. I guess that's how you say Solarinite bomb that threatens the universe. This movie, it's got Vampira. It's got Tor Johnson coming back as zombies. So you got zombies in this movie, even though it's a space movie. It gets 66 on Rotten Tomatoes. I would probably bump it up to a 70 because I was entertained the whole time I was watching it. It's hilarious. It is somewhat influential. And it just makes me think we really need to do a double feature of the movie Ed Wood and the movie Gods and Monsters, which one's about Ed Wood, one's about James Whale.
I think that would be
an interesting double feature. Dennis came in from time to time while I was watching this because I was laughing so hard. And he was like, what is this? But yeah, Plan 9 from Outer Space. And it's been, I guess it's been restored because it looked really clean, the copy I saw.
But isn't it considered on a lot of lists as one of the worst movies ever made? I
mean, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I have definitely seen worse movies. I watched a worse movie the other night that may be on my genre list. I can't remember what it was called. Oh, The Beast with a Thousand Eyes is far worse than this.
Yes, I would agree with that. Yeah.
This at least had a few decent actors and
humor. I also think there's an elevation that goes with it. This movie has been lauded as so bad, so many people have watched it.
Oh, yeah.
And you glorify in, because I remember seeing, this is probably 10, 12 years ago, but someone had turned it into a stage play.
It would work.
I saw images, and I saw pictures from the stage play and was going, yeah, that works. I would love to do that. That would make a great play.
The set would be the interior of the spaceship, the graveyard, and one house. That's about it.
And yeah, it would be interesting to see that. But so, yeah, that's a, okay. How do we transition out of
it? It's a sci-fi movie, and it's going to be on our list. I think it's already on our list. I just haven't chosen it yet. Or you have to choose it. That's why.
It's also one of those that is, you, at the time, you know, had the huge graphics, and it was almost an homage to the 50s movies, which is what we're covering today.
Because it's 1962. Yeah, you're right. It is an homage to the 50s movies.
We are covering, for those of you who are trying to keep up, follow us along in your hymnals sort of thing, we are going back to 1951. 1951, a film directed by Rudolph Matej, written by Sidney Boehm, Edwin Balmer, and Philip Wiley, based on Edwin Balmer and Philip Wiley's original novel, When Worlds Collide.
When Worlds Collide. Written in the stars is a message of doom for this, our world. And now in the most shattering experience the screen has ever given you, Paramount tells what could happen within your lifetime when worlds collide. An astronomer checks and double-checks his horrifying discovery. A distant star racing through space toward an inevitable collision with this planet. The United Nations meet in emergency session. All conflicts pale before this threat from another world.
If you wait until the danger is visible to the naked eye, it will be too late to escape.
High on a mountaintop, an army of scientists work desperately to build this giant rocket, this modern Noah's Ark to carry a few picked survivors of our doomed civilization to a new life on another world, reaching the heights of self-sacrifice, the depths of the animal lust for survival as they fight to be among the few who can be saved.
Let's take the ship away from them! Come on!
Fighting among themselves, fighting against time, as doomsday is upon them.
I think all you scientists are crackpots.
Nothing is going to happen.
When worlds collide, you'll see the most amazing, awe-inspiring scenes ever put on film. The forces of nature unleashed in all their terrifying force. Tremendous tidal waves smashing New York City. The molten fires from the bowels of the earth gushing out to consume our world.
And basically, most people say George Powell's When Worlds Collide, because that's how it's associated. A brief synopsis, if you, first of all, spoilers, if you have not seen this, go watch it now before you come back to us, because we do spoil everything, because we're talking about references in this movie and up to this movie. But basically, scientists find out that there is, in the movie, they call it a star. It's not a star, it's just a planet, but hey, that there are not only one, but two, a star and a planet is what they call it in the movie, so let's go with that, that are now suddenly on a trajectory to Earth. One of them will pass very close by, which will cause, of course, a lot of climate and tectonic changes, and then the second one will literally collide with the planet and destroy Earth. Ooh, what do we do? The scientists all get together and say, it looks like that one planet might be habitable. It does have an atmosphere, so we might be able to construct some form of rocket, some form of ship, something that would allow at least a portion, a few people, to maintain the human race if we can land on that planet after it's gone past the orbit of Earth, and they so do so. It came out in 51. It's been revived a few times in different incarnations and lists and everything else. Had you seen this movie before?
No, I had never seen this
movie. Oh, really? Oh, okay, cool. Now I'm curious. What did one think of this?
I liked it for what it is and its place in the sci-fi canon of the 1950s. It is definitely an influential movie because we're still making movies like this. However, some of it's really hokey. Some of the acting's really hokey, and some of the special effects look, even the miniature work is somewhat dated and not very good in this. I've seen better miniature work in Godzilla movies.
Okay.
But I didn't hate it. I enjoyed it because I had never seen it before and I was curious.
Let's talk about some of the why. So from a production angle, this movie, the rights to this movie were originally bought. Do you know by who? Who bought the first ones? First time?
Yeah, I think I do.
Check them notes.
Yeah. No, it wasn't Irwin Allen, but that would have been funny if it was.
No, but that's a huge key for us.
Yeah.
Come on. Cecil B. DeMille.
Oh, yeah, I did know that. He wanted to do both books. He wanted to do this and After Worlds Collide or whatever.
Correct.
The second one.
Because this was a duology, as they say now. It was two novels that they published together, or published separately, that came out separately. But he wanted to do both and wanted to follow it up with a sequel of After Worlds Collide. But the Great Depression happened and it kind of tanked everything. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it came back to Paramount and George Powell. George Powell had a lot of success because he had done a space movie already and that had garnered some clout. So they said, hey, we'll let you do it. However, you have literally less than half of the budget you requested and you have 27 days to shoot it. Period. You can spend up to a year, which they did, doing special effects later. And some of the special effects still hold up, some of them.
Yeah, some of them are pretty good. The movie in question that you were talking about was Destination Moon.
Correct.
That he did that was so well received.
Yes.
Because he didn't do War of the Worlds until after this.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Which to me is the best of them all. But
much better script, too. Come on.
Sort of thing. And monsters.
Yes, definitely villains in it. The villains in this are humans. That's why this, I'll just say right now, if you're looking for reboot and all that BS that people want to do and all the time, redo this movie.
They did. It's called Armageddon.
Yeah. Nope. No, sir. No. But anyway, I would hold this movie up any day to Armageddon, but come on. Even George Powell, though, wanted to do a sequel to it. So he wanted to do After Worlds Collide. It did not do well, other than it did win awards and stuff, which you'll get to later
on.
I'll
get to that.
One of the things, and it's a pseudo key, but one of the things that attracted both Cecil B. DeMille, who had garnered a lot of attention because of the Ten Commandments, and George Powell, was this was Noah's Ark. This was a modern science fiction version of Noah's Ark.
Right.
And so that's what attracted both of them to it, sort of thing. Scenes? Were there scenes that worked for you or didn't work for you, or you remember?
Well, I was going to say, and this is a scene, you were asking me about getting to the good of the movie. Two of the things that are the bad are the opening with the Bible quotes.
And the fact that you are credits and we're going, boom, right?
Yeah. God is going to wipe out the earth and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, this is a little heavy handed.
A little, yeah.
It's very heavy-handed. And then some of the science is just so wonky in this. The fact that it's a star with a – or a planet with a star behind it. Is that what it is that's coming to hit the Earth? And the planet passes us first, and then the star collides into us?
Ballast. Yeah, if you read the novel, the novel, it's two separate planetoids, so to speak.
Okay.
One goes really close to the Earth and goes past it and on toward the sun. The other
creates
one
creates all the havoc. Yeah.
The other one does the same thing, but this one goes into a tighter elliptical orbit and comes back to crash into the Earth, whereas the other one now becomes in an orbit around Earth, essentially replacing the third planet.
Again, very wonky.
Could still work. It's not that it's outrageously impossible if it's caught in the gravity of the sun sort of thing. But what makes the novel really cool is all these disbelievers, they take off from Earth trying to catch up to Zyra, which takes a while. And Belus is circling the sun coming back. So there's 18 months for them on Earth after all these earthquakes, after all of these tsunamis, after parts of civilization have collapsed. They have 18 months before this thing is going to come back and hit the planet. So you have 18 months of terror on Earth.
Awesome.
Sort of thing, which would have been really a cool kind of story. It would be neat to take just that part of it.
Yeah.
Scenes.
I have to say, this is going to be stupid, but this one of the scenes that sticks out the most to me is when, who is the bad guy? Starts with an S.
Oh, the
Stanton.
Yeah.
When his assistant decides he's going to take the lottery ticket and pulls a gun.
Yeah.
And it's essentially the actor that plays Sam Drucker from Green Acres being a bad guy.
Yes.
I was like, I never thought I would see Sam Drucker be a bad guy. So that scene sticks out a lot to me.
And Stanton shot him through his blanket.
Yeah, I'm like, why does he have a gun in his blanket underneath his, while he's in a wheelchair?
That didn't surprise me because he was the one that said from the very beginning, you need guns.
That's true.
I do the fact that Stanton, for all of the, he is that, I'm uber rich. It doesn't matter if I'm crippled or handicapped or in a wheelchair or not. I am uber rich. I'm funding this, so I want my way. And the scientists keep standing up to him, saying, no, we're going to do what's right. And we don't care that you've already wasted your money.
But let's get that girl's boyfriend on here.
But yeah, let's make sure the girl's boy, the Danny Kaye lookalike, let's make sure that he gets on here.
Yeah.
That was a good scene. I liked the scene before that when Belos actually comes close and they actually have the earthquake start and all the volcanoes erupt and all that kind of stuff, because they actually built the set on gimbals and they shook the whole set with all the cast on it, so much so that they're falling onto desks and lamps are falling on their heads and shit. I was going, yeah, cool.
I like the scene where the ship actually takes off because it's a really bizarre launch pad.
Yes.
It's in that picture behind me when it goes up a ramp, basically. And we're so used to seeing rockets go straight up from history. It's just funny to see their interpretation.
Yeah. And they said from the very beginning that was the best way to get escape velocity. Because remember, right now, Artemis and everything else, those rockets are incredibly powerful. And back in the 50s, they didn't think they would ever have anything that could make that much thrust. So by sending it down a hill and up over a mountain, we're giving it extra momentum to get to Zyra and create a new planet and everything else.
Speaking of scenes, the scene where they're on the new planet at the end is a little odd. It's a backdrop, quite clearly, but it looks like that it's inhabited because there's pyramids in the background.
Very good point, because that's what part of Afterworlds Collide
is.
Afterworlds Collide is about. And most people miss it. Most people, they're so thrown off because suddenly we went to a Disney
cartoon production land. Shot,
cartoon land, and this is what
sending you to cartoon land.
Yeah. What is this? Roger Rabbit in space? What are we?
It does look really weird.
But you
it is
do.
Not. Who is that guy that did the thing, backdrops, what? That was so good?
Oh, Ellison?
The painter.
Yeah.
The backdrops, it was so good because he obviously did not do this one.
Ellenshaw is that gentleman. Richard Ellenshaw did all the backdrops.
I thought it was something else, but anyway, okay.
But yes, you do at the very end of that pan when they're hugging each other, pyramids in the background because
there's one with even little openings on it.
That was still George Powell saying, hey, this is part of the sequel. Because in the sequel, of course, they go into those pyramids and there's actually alien life and they have to
xenomorphs
run around. Yeah. turn them all into zombies. That'll work.
Hey, face huggers.
I like as far as scenes go, of course, I love the scene where Stanton doesn't get to get on the ship and the scientist sacrificed not only himself, but Stanton.
Okay, that's a scene for me too, because all of a sudden he can walk and I'm like, what? Wait,
you're
in a wheelchair.
But to me, and I almost put it in as a key, but that's like the very end of Dr. Strangelove. When he stands up and goes, I feel I can walk. And then they cut to the explosion sort of thing. I thought the same thing. Yeah, he's so desperate that they're going to let him stand in his wheelchair. Okay, sure, whatever. But I also like leading up to that because Stanton has said from the beginning, you better put guns in this complex because desperate people will do desperate things. You'll need to protect. And to me, that was a very true statement. And they showed it, that with these guys panicking and climbing over the fences and trying to get to the ship and all of that kind of stuff. At the same time, when they realized it was all falling apart. And why are we going along with this lottery? But I love the whole lead up to that with this montage of them getting ready. And you keep hearing the narrator supposedly over the intercom of the complex going, Bellos is getting closer. We only have 19 days. Work faster. Work faster. You're going, is he sitting in the control room saying all that with a microphone?
Yeah. Just, strange.
Team 14, you're falling behind. Yeah. It seems like you would take off, to your point about the science earlier, seems like you would take off a lot sooner. Before you could see a big red freaking planet eclipsing the sun's diameter, take off before then. That would be smarter. That would be better.
Less exciting, though.
Yeah. Okay, so you said Mr. Drucker. We've got other people sort of
thing. Oh, Cass. Yeah, we can do that. Let's see. This movie stars Richard Durr as David Randall. He is the romantic lead. What's that?
He is Danny Kaye's brother. I cannot watch this movie without thinking he reminds me of Danny Kaye so much.
He's a little better looking than Danny, but yeah, I see what you mean with the curly hair. Sorry, I just got distracted by my notes.
That's okay. Notes do that.
Rudolf Matej that directed it was also nominated for Oscars 5 times for cinematography. I don't know if you had mentioned that. All right. Anyway, back to Richard Durr, who plays Randall. When George Powell began this adaption, he wanted it to be much more lavish, but he was forced with budget cuts to scale back. So originally, Douglas Fairbanks Jr. was considered for this role.
Now, see, I had read that's what Paramount wanted, but George Powell intentionally wanted newcomers because he didn't want stars in this movie.
But wouldn't Douglas Fairbanks be too old to play a young man in this movie?
Yeah.
Because he was like a silent movie, or at least the 30s.
Yeah, he was in the 30s, so he would have been in his 50s for this.
Yeah, that's a little old, but I guess that's typical Hollywood. Okay, anyway, Richard Durr, don't know much about him. He's mostly a television actor, as are most of the people in this. So, yeah. And speaking of which, Barbara Rush is next. She played Joyce Hendren. We last saw her in It Came from Outer Space last season, I believe. Didn't mm-hmm. we do that last season? I think yeah. we did. And then I knew her from Magnificent Obsession, which is a Douglas Sirk movie with Rock Hudson. That's all I really have to say about her. She's another queen of TV shows. She was on a lot of television. Peter Hansen plays Dr. Tony Drake. I know him as Lee Baldwin from General Hospital.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. He was on General Hospital for a very long time and was the father of Scotty Baldwin, one of my favorite characters on that show. John Hoyt plays Sidney Stanton, the mean rich guy, I guess you'd say, the investor.
The entrepreneur.
The one that can walk at the end, even though he's in a wheelchair.
Yep.
He's played by John Hoyt. We know him best as Dr. Philip Boyce in The Cage, the original Star Trek pilot. I don't know him from anything else except television. Very familiar face. Larry Keating played Cole Hendren. Don't know anything about him. Rachel Ames played Julie Cummings. Rachel Ames was also on General Hospital. She played Audrey Hardy and was the longest running performer on ABC's Daytime's longest running daytime drama. She was on there from February of 1964 until less than a year before the final air date a few years ago.
Okay.
So she was on General Hospital for a long time. And she was also obviously friends with Peter Hansen, who played Lee Baldwin.
Yeah.
So two General Hospital alumni in this movie. I find that not quite coincidental.
No.
Stephen Chase plays Dr. George Fry. If his face looks familiar to you, it's because we saw him in The Blob a few seasons back.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Isn't he like the father of the girl? He's like the pharmacist.
Pharmacist, yeah.
I may be confusing it with the remake of The Blob, but anyway. And as I mentioned earlier, Harold Ferris is the character that is Stanton's little henchman, played by Frank Cady.
Yep.
Frank Cady is best known as Sam Drucker on three sitcoms, The Beverly Hillbillies, Green Acres, and Petticoat Junction. So he played that character on three shows.
But he was in the same store.
And before that, he did good movies. He was in Rear Window, and he was in The Bad mm-hmm. Seed. We just remember him most for being friendly Sam Drucker on television and a bad guy now apparently in When Worlds Collide.
Yeah.
And then this one struck me as very interesting. Hayden Rourke played Dr. Emery Bronson. Now, he's a very familiar face from television as well. He played Dr. Bellows on I Dream of Jeannie.
Oh, yeah. I've forgotten that. You're right. Yeah.
I just decided I'm going to do a little research on him. Found out he's gay. His partner was Justice Addis.
Nuh-uh.
The two men met on the film Project Moonbase in 1950. Moonbase. Have you ever heard of that?
I have not.
All right. He directed Rourke in four episodes of the Schlitz Playhouse, all in 1955, and one episode of Goodyear Summer Originals in 1956. They were together from 1953 until Addis's death in 1979. So there's you, an old gay television actor I had no idea about.
You're supposed to know all of these gay television.
And it is my goal to learn.
Yeah.
Lastly, Sandro Giglio, if that's how I'm saying it right, Sandro Giglio played Dr. Ottinger. Last we saw him was as Dr. Bilderbeck in War of the Worlds. So he comes along later in another George Powell movie.
Yeah. And as we've said, a much better George Powell movie.
Right, a much better. As far as awards, this movie won an Oscar for special effects. So all those miniatures, like the one behind me that I was making fun of, actually won an Oscar.
Yes.
It was also nominated for cinematography, which, knowing Pathé, that's no mistake. He's nominated many times. However, this movie is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die list. And I agree with that compared to some of the other 50 sci-fi movies.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. I don't think it deserves, even though it won the Oscar, I don't think it deserves to be on that list, really. No. There were some things. I've got some watch notes that I like. Like, even in 51, with the advent of the past decade where we had built Oak Ridge and Los Alamos and everything else, you would not be able to build this complex and this ship and everything in 8 months, which is the time frame they gave themselves. And I think that's because they wanted that countdown clock sort of feel in the plot, but it's not feasible. It just, that makes no real sense that any government, no matter how much money you put into it, would be able to build something this complex in 8 months.
That's why they had that guy saying, "You work harder. You're falling behind."
You're falling behind. I have, yeah, and like you said, science in general, I've got it several times. Calling it a star, that was a huge mistake. I think they were trying to placate to the general public or people out there who weren't science savvy, saying, how would you explain two objects coming toward us? It's a star and it's a planet. Oh, I understand that. No, it's just two planets sort of thing. Almost like comets, asteroids, yada.
But even would it be a planet? It would be an asteroid.
Or a planetoid. It could be a planetoid with a hugely long orbit that we weren't aware of thing.
Okay.
Because in the novel, they even talk about the theory that both of these planets passing close to us is what caused the dinosaurs to die. It wasn't an impact. It was they were so close, they created climate upheaval. Mm-hmm. And that was the last time they were orbited around. So that's how far their orbit is. But yeah, if you had a star, if literally Belos was a star, it would have its own gravity, its own brightness, its own, it'd be massive global. And
it would wipe out every planet in its path. I mean, correct. Yeah.
You would create a binary star system. It would just be, science doesn't make sense. By the same token, little things like, if there's oxygen there or not, it's the only thing we have to breathe. Open that hatch up.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. No. Even a scientist wouldn't do that. Good or bad, it's the only place we have.
They all fall out of it dead.
Yeah. I've got other stuff like, so you get this wonderful shot that they're used to that they establish in two of the scenes where you see the pilots in the front, in the foreground, and then behind them are all these rows and rows of all of the 40, I think 47 people is what, how many they could
I've got a picture of it. It doesn't even look like that many, but yeah.
But all these people, they're survivors, and
yeah, I guess it would be about 40.
There's not one person of color in that entire show.
Oh, no. Only white people live.
Only rich white people can go to the new planet to start our, yeah.
We're repopulating. No. not very diverse at all.
Yeah, they are not doing the DEI sort of thing. No.
No.
And then the last one I have is just, there's one quote where, and I forgot and didn't write down who said it, but somebody says, that's the last dawn, or let's look at the last dawn.
I do remember that.
And that would have made a much better title for this movie. And would have been really cool if it had been The Last Dawn. Because
I don't know. I kind of like the alliteration of When Worlds Collide.
Yeah, there's that. But
yeah, The Last Dawn could be the remake.
All right, good. Let's work on it. The keys?
I have a slew of them, actually.
Sure.
The first one I have is Star Trek.
Of course.
Which is just pretty obvious. But then I go into what I'm talking about as far as modern equivalents, and that is movies like Independence Day. That's actually an alien invasion. But The Day After Tomorrow, Armageddon, those things that have climate upheaval.
Well, Deep Impact was one. Yeah, I've got that.
But then you also mentioned Irwin Allen, and you've got movies like Earthquake as far as special effects. That's a direct tie-in to this movie.
Tower
Inferno. Even the Poseidon Adventure, because they do a scene with the sea up above the buildings and stuff. Of course, in Poseidon Adventure, it was just a big tidal wave. But
Yep. I've got a very original key because, according to research that I did, Flash Gordon, which came out in 1934, was influenced by this novel.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You just made me think of something else, but go ahead.
So that's like a huge reference because Flash Gordon then influenced so many other things, including Star Wars, going down through science fiction history. That's kind of the reason of why Lucas even did Star Wars was he did a movie that we are going to talk about soon was he was trying to work on a new adaptation of Flash Gordon. Hint, hint, of watch a later episode and find out. But I've got a technical thing. The V1 rocket was the inspiration for the actual spaceship design. It was designed after the V1, which was, of course, developed by the Germans during World War II.
Okay.
I've got War of the Worlds.
I've got a recent one. Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I've got one that we did last year, and it's Oxygen.
Yeah.
Because we discover that the plot twist of that movie is basically to repopulate another world. So there's a very common theme there.
There is a very, not very well watched or popular movie called Melancholia by Lars von Trier that is like that too. It is based on trying to find a new home for the survivors of Earth. It's very similar. So I would put it as a key to Melancholia.
Okay.
I've got War of the Worlds. We've mentioned it. It was George Powell's magnum opus. It's much better than this movie. But there are parts of this movie that feel like War of the Worlds. The same film stock, the same kind of look, that same kind of opening narration with
religion. The religion.
The religious allegory all the way through it. Yeah, very George Powell feel to it.
Sorry, I got choked.
You did?
But yeah, as soon as you said it, I was like, oh my God, all that religious stuff at the beginning is right out of War of the Worlds.
Yep.
I mentioned Deep Impact, but I realized when I was doing further research that Deep Impact originated as a combination of a remake of this and an adaptation of Arthur C. Clarke's novel, The Hammer of God.
The Hammer of God, which I just listened to on audiobook, and it's really good. Yeah.
But then as the project developed further and further, it got so far away from either one of them, they didn't even have to credit it.
Yeah, no.
So Deep Impact's its own thing. But so you know the story then that I just mentioned.
I've got a couple that I picked up off of IMDb or online or whatever, however my research works. One is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And I didn't know this. And I'm going to look back and see because I haven't double checked this.
I saw that.
The cargo containers are labeled Belos and Zyra, which are the two planet names. I did not. I have seen Wrath of Khan probably 40 times. And
right,
I don't think
too.
I have ever seen Zyra or Belos.
I wouldn't have known, but you would have.
So, yeah, I'm going to have to go back and see if that's true or if that's in maybe an extended cut or something that's not out there. But anyway, there you go.
I saw that too. I've got that it was adapted into a comic book by George Evans in Motion Picture Comics number 110, May of 1952.
Ah, okay.
So this would be quite a collectible comic book, I would think.
That would be. After I saw this, I suddenly thought, man, I should have pitched this as a double feature for our season with Crack in the World. Do you remember that movie in 65? Have you ever seen that one?
No, I don't think so.
It's very similar, and all the keys would still work. All of the, you know, the Irwin Allen keys, all of the advanced keys up to now. Basically, scientists find out that because we have been doing underground nuclear testing, we have created literally a crack in the substratum mantle of the Earth, and it's going to, before we can stop it, it's going to split the whole planet in two. So it's a huge disaster movie. But with scientists trying to figure out how do we survive, make humanity survive? Can we go to Mars? Can we go to Venus? What do we do? It's really cool. It would have worked as a double feature with this really well. Called Crack in the World.
Interesting.
Yeah. What else?
I have that Terry Pratchett and Stephen Baxter have a novel called The Long War. Ooh. Have you heard of this?
No.
In it, the scientists have named the theoretical space object which obliterated one of the alternate Earths, Bellows.
Okay.
Which the character Sally Lindsley describes as some dumb old movie reference.
Some dumb old movie? What? Sally doesn't know.
Being silly.
I think the last one I have is, and you may not have seen it, and this is a huge spoiler alert to anybody, but in The Expanse, the series that I love, that is one of the best sci-fi series in the past 50 years, they start weaponizing asteroids to attack different planets and different ships and everything else. So they use them and their gravitational pull to the inner planets and everything else as weapons. And it's very similar to this, the destruction that can happen when you actually shoot a rock into another planet sort of thing. So, yeah.
Interesting. I have a couple of music ones. Yeah, but they're not people I've ever heard of. There is a 1975 album called When Worlds Collide by a band called The Straubs. It's a British band, and they actually had a single called Did Worlds Collide?
Oh.
And then it is also the title of a single by the heavy metal band Power Man 5000. From 1999, Tonight the Stars Revolt is the name of the album.
I thought you were going to mention Rocky. So
that was going to be my last one. And it is definitely a key, and we've said this with any of these 50 sci-fi movies we do, that ended up being mentioned in the science fiction double feature song, which opens Rocky Horror Picture Show. And I got curious again. I was like, we've covered a lot of movies from that song now.
Yeah.
What have we not covered?
Ooh.
And there are three. One you just mentioned, and that's the Flash Gordon serial.
Yeah.
And we will never cover that.
No.
We might cover the other movie from 1980, but
yep.
Might cover it real soon.
With Jonathan Rhys Davies and everybody, yeah.
Yeah. But the other two films that are in it that we've never covered are Dr. X, which I have recorded but not watched, and Day of the Triffids.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we should do Day of the Triffids. It would be fun, especially if we based it off the novel, too. So, yeah.
That's Jack Finney, isn't it? Isn't it the same guy that did Body Snatchers? I think it is.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I was going to let this Rocky Horror be my last one. I don't think I have any others.
That should be it. I think that's great. We've done a bunch on this one. So that kind of says, regardless of how good the quality of the special effects were, Oscar winning or not, and how kind of crazy the science and wonky everything was, this was actually a very influential movie, you know, going forward.
For sure.
And
just
telling
like Plan
9
from Outer Space.
Yeah, telling this kind of disaster story that how does humanity survive in coming climatic change sort of thing. There you go.
Yeah, so I guess that's going to do it today for When Worlds Collide, which I am glad that I got to see because I had never seen it before. It had been on my list for quite some time. We would like to know what you folks think. We've told you what we think. Please leave us a comment down below. Have you seen When Worlds Collide? Is it on your list or is it one that you're very familiar with? And hey, No, I'm just kidding. Or love. And we appreciate you being here with us. We hope you enjoyed what you've heard. This is our second episode of the ninth season. I forgot to mention that early on. We've been doing this for a while now, and we could always use your support, whether you want to leave us comments and communicate with us, or if you want to give us a little bit more support, you can go over to Patreon, where we do have some free stuff, as well as some subscription tiers for other things, predominantly television, sci-fi, and horror. We've kind of delved several seasons into Star Trek and several seasons into The X-Files. And we do plan to branch out eventually, maybe into something else. Other than that, I guess next week we're going back into horror territory.
We are.
With the Master, if I'm not mistaken. So I will see you then.
I'll see you then.
All right. Take care.
Bye.